I'd like to bring the meeting of the Carson City Airport Authority together for Wednesday, June 21st, 6 o'clock, Carson City Community Center Sierra Room. I'd like to have the secretary call the roll, please.
Chairperson Law.
Here.
Vice Chair Stotts. Member Barrett.
Here.
Member Harvey.
Here.
Member Torres.
Here.
Member Val.
Here.
Member White.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Thank you. Would you join me for the Pledge of Allegiance, please? Does anyone have any questions about the minutes from last meeting? Do I have a motion to accept?
So moved.
That was Brian. Member Val has moved. Do I have a second? Second from Member Torres. All in favor? Any discussion on the motion, first of all? All in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? So passed. Modification of the agenda. The chairman reserves the right to modify the agenda in order to most effectively process the agenda items. Items may be taken out of order. Items may be combined for consideration by the authority. Items may be pulled or removed from the agenda at any time. Public comment. Members of the public who wish to address the airport authority may speak on agendized and non-agendized matters related to the airport. Comments are limited to 3 minutes per person or topic. If your item requires extended discussion, please request the chairman to calendar the matter for the future airport authority meeting. Is there any public comment at this time? Hearing none, we will move forward to the public hearing items on item F1 for possible action, election of officers, chairman, vice chair, and secretary treasurer per NRS 844, section 6. At this point in time, I would like to open the nominations for chairman.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to nominate Linda Law for chairman.
Are there...
Second.
Okay.
Lots of seconds. Well, we know how this goes. What's going.
Do we have any other nominations for chair? Do we have any public comment on nominations for chair? I'd like to move on and do this as a combined item. Do I have a nomination for vice chairman? Member Torres.
Nominate Brian Vowell for vice chair.
Brian. Do I
second.
Have a... Member White has seconded. Do I have any public comment on that item? Do I have any other nominations for vice chair? I'd like to close the nominations for vice chair, seeing no others. And I would like to move on to nominations for Secretary Treasurer. Member White.
I nominate Member Harvey for Secretary Treasurer.
Second.
I have a nomination from Member White and a second from Member Barrett. Do I have any other nominations? Do I have any public comment on that nomination? I'd like to close the nominations, and we have a slate of myself as chair, Member Val as vice chair, and Member Harvey as secretary treasurer. Do I have any public comment before we go to a vote? Do I have any discussion on the motion, on the slate? All in favor of adopting the slate of officers as nominated, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? So moved and carried. Item number F2 for possible action to approve the request by Nevada Department of Transportation NDOT to operate unmanned aerial vehicles, aka unmanned aircraft systems or drones under 55 pounds, within 5 miles of the Carson City Airport in furtherance of NDOT business. Is there anyone here from NDOT? I'm not seeing anybody. Mr. Rowe, would you like to handle that?
Ms. Adams was not able to attend, but NDOT has required drones to be used for the purposes related to their operations, surveying, aerial photography, things like that's related to their properties. NRS 493-109 prohibits operations of an unmanned aerial vehicle within 5 miles of the airport unless the operator obtains consent of the airport authority. This has been done in the past with the city, Public Works, the fire department, and other entities. And so the NDOT is requesting the same consideration.
Good evening. I'm Brad Graber. I don't know how to do that. How do you turn it on? Thanks. At what altitude are these drones going to be flown?
They are prohibited at 400 feet or lower, AGL.
Thanks.
I have a question.
Member Val.
Do we know, did they mention what they're going to be doing with it, why they need permission?
As I said, they're going to be using it for their operations over their properties, highways, whatever NDOT is in charge of, some aerial surveillance, I assume, photography, and whatever else they need it for. So, just to clarify, they also... If they're going to fly within 5 miles of the airport, they will have to notify me of when and where.
Okay, so that was going to be my question, if we expect any conflicts with the airport, traffic patterns, or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
Any further questions?
Yeah,
Member Barrett.
Is it usual that somebody doesn't show up for, this is... something I think they should show up for and answer any questions we might have. Not that I think it's, is it routine to do it this way?
A few months ago, I believe it was a realtor, had submitted a request for the same, and they didn't show. The airport authority did approve that use, and I notified the realtor of the restrictions the next day.
He didn't know the restrictions before he saw it?
No, my restrictions.
Oh, you're...
I don't want him to fly unless I know about it.
He didn't know that was the case before he applied?
Yeah, I just reiterated that.
Oh, okay.
If I remember correctly, he had provided us copies of his license and his procedures and all that sort of thing, as had the NDOT.
News people, too.
Yes, mm-hmm. Correct. So this is basically the same kind of service, same kind of activities that we approved before.
Yeah.
I felt the same way about the news organization. It was television, as I recall. I think they should show, but that's up to you,
Council, take us. Do you have any input on that?
No, it's up to you guys how you want to proceed.
Do we want to table it until they show up?
No, I believe last time I abstained, I'll probably do the same thing this time. I just think it's poor form to have one government agency request something and then just assume we're going to grant it.
Any further comments on that item? Any other public comment on that item? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion. And the motion can be either to go forward with it or to table it. I have no preference.
I move that we move forward and approve their request. That doesn't look anything in here that looks like it would conflict with what we're doing, so I don't see why we shouldn't approve it.
Second.
Motion by Member Vowell and seconded by Member Harvey. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor of the motion?
Before you vote, can I just clarify?
Certainly.
You're approving it so long as they fully comply with FAA Part 107 and that they notify the airport manager at least 24 hours prior to operations that are within a mile of the airport. Is that, I'm just clarifying.
Yes, what you said.
Okay, great, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
I'll abstain.
Member Barrett abstains. Motion carries. Thank you. Moving forward to item F4 for possible action regarding the request. Wait a minute. Yeah. Sorry. Approval for possible act. I went to the dentist today and my brain still isn't working, so I apologize to you folks. Item F3 for possible action, approval of a proposal to leave the West Wing, to lease the West Wing of the Terminal Building to Carson Aviation Adventures for its flight school and determination of a monthly rental rate.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Val. Yes.
Could we have it for the record that Vice Chair Val is recusing himself?
Yes.
Yes, and I've stepped down from the
You need to make that declaration publicly.
Okay.
Yes, disclosure.
So this is Brian Val, standing at the podium on behalf of Carson Aviation Adventures in my own capacity. Several months ago, actually, late last year, we made a request to see if we could lease the terminal building after the roof was finished. We have as a flight school, we have agreements with several other flight schools, and we have an immediate need for additional area to do private briefings. We have an agreement that's been on hold with a major airline pending us having some space to do those private briefings. The current space that we have is inadequate for that. We're going to continue leasing our current space. We're not giving anything up. We just need to expand in some additional space. The area in the west end of the terminal building that was previously a kitchen and a prep area works, in our minds, works perfect for that. So this lease agreement that we submitted, this draft agreement, basically covers all of those issues on that. So the question came to what are we going to do with it? That's the reason we need the space. Secondly, what are we going to pay for it? Reviewing the airport budget and seeing that there's quite a bit of expenses for things like phone and internet, there were discussions that I've had with Manager Rowe regarding getting better, faster internet service available for not just the offices for the airport administration, but also for the public that might be using the transit area within the terminal. So we have a very high-speed connection that we've already expended money to buy equipment to bring that connection into the terminal building and provide internet service and phone service in lieu of actual cash on a monthly basis for leasing the space. Also recently, Reno Flying Service in Reno has just shut down their training services. So there no longer is a written testing center in the Reno Carson Tahoe area. We've applied to PSI and CATS. Those are the two companies that are under contract with the FAA to provide written testing. They have reviewed our application, and they're requesting us to show them private areas where the actual tests can be conducted under surveillance and, you know, high-speed internet available, bathrooms available, ADA accessible. The west end of the building for us meets all those needs, so we would also like to kind of do double duty. As well as doing private briefing areas, we'd like to open up a testing center there so that members of the public that need to get written testing completed through CATS and through PSI can come by and test there. Now, the CATS and PSI stuff is not all 100% FAA related, so there are professional programs with like Microsoft and Cisco where people need to come in and get tested for those materials, and this would be done in the same area. So what we'd like to do with the space is to do that. We'd like to have one of the rooms on the west side set up as a classroom and one of the rooms set up as an area where we have partitions for individual people that are either taking tests or debriefing after and before flights so that we can meet the requirements of what that airline is looking for as well as meet the requirements for the public for both Washoe, Carson, Lyon, as well as Truckee and Tahoe. The nearest testing center right now, if you were training to be a pilot and you wanted to get your private license and you need to go take the written test, the nearest one is in Auburn. The next nearest one is the other side of Sacramento. So it's kind of a burden right now that folks have to drive for a couple hours just to go take a written test. Literally, it takes longer to drive down there and back than it does to do the test. So we'd like to be able to do that here in Carson and drive a lot of those folks in to see us. In regards to the terms of the agreement, we originally asked for a 10-year term. Mr. Takis said that the NRS doesn't allow that, so now I think we've adjusted it to, is it 3 years plus one and one renewal possibility?
It's three plus two. It's effectively five
three
years.
Three plus two to make it effectively 5 years.
And then at the end of the 5 years, you can reapproach the authority.
Okay. So we have taken the amount of capital expenditures that we're going to have to do to get the infrastructure in place to provide the internet services and the phone services, and we've amortized those over 5 years. The number that we came out with exceeds what the lease value of that property would have been, and that was just based on a quick check of what we're paying for rent at our current location and a discussion with Manager Rowe. The amount of square footage, I think, came to, was it 300-something feet? Somewhere around there. Five what? 576?
576.
Okay, so the 576 feet at like a 20 or 30 cent per foot rate actually comes out to less than the amount of what we're actually going to be spending and supplying in terms of in-kind services. So there was also an issue, I think there was a question. We had asked for exclusivity. The latest draft has that stricken. Our exclusivity request was not necessarily that nobody else at the airport can do flight training. It was just we didn't. It was our strong preference that other people not do flight training in the area where we would be doing flight training, because otherwise we're literally subsidizing the facility for our competition to use it. So we'd ask for that. I don't know if we can even do that. Is that what the recommendation was not?
Yeah, the exclusivity, I think, would violate the FAA assurances that say okay. We can't do exclusive leases. But we've gone, I think, as far as we can go in that regard by giving you a right of first refusal
okay.
for releasing or leasing any of the other areas in,
okay.
in the building. So
the other ask, the right of first refusal is now Section 27. Long term, we have plans to do a charter service in and out of Carson, and we would like to use the terminal building for doing that charter service. So the request for the right of first refusal is that when such time comes along that we have the airplane available, we have the charter certificate from the FAA, we're up and running and ready to go, we would like to go in and request that we lease the remainder of the terminal building that's available, which would be the main area inside the round rotunda area, on a non-exclusive basis. So basically, we would like to be able to go in there, clean it up, make it meet our branding guidelines, kind of modernize it, you know, new paint, new flooring, whatever it takes to make it fit with what we've currently done in our existing space in the flight school, and then run the charter operation out of there, pick up, drop off passengers and cargo as needed. The long-term goal is an on-demand charter, and this is discussions that we've had with the local FAA office. They actually were the ones that had the idea and made the suggestion to us that we're halfway there. As a 141 school, we have a lot of procedures and operations manuals that are already in place. So a lot of the legwork that would be required to get a certificate to do charter services is already done. And in their minds, they made the suggestion and said, you should do this. And I said, that's a great idea. I'll get right on that next year. So that's what the ask is in terms of why we're asking for right of first refusal. And, again, since it would be a non-exclusive lease on this shared space, the rate that we had originally requested in there was basically half of what we thought fair market value was, since it would not be our exclusive leasehold. It would be open to the public to use as they see fit. We currently have quite a bit of traffic coming through the flight school. Folks that are – we're open pretty late usually, so folks see the light on. They come, they see us when the terminal building is dark. So we're already getting quite a bit of foot traffic. We want to shift that over there and basically use the terminal building for its intended use, which is as a terminal for, you know, folks coming in and out of Carson.
Okay, I have a question for you. You didn't mention the tenant improvements.
Tenant improvements, yes. So as part of from the original discussion that I had with Manager Rowe, it was basically we agreed that we would do the tenant improvements on the space. So the space, for those who have not seen it, is still as it was left when the restaurant pulled out. So there's still tile on the floor in the kitchen area. There are gas, there are sewer, there's water, stuff that's just capped up. So we would be responsible for ripping that out, rehabbing it, and taking it to an office standard away from the current industrial kitchen that it looks like right now. So I'm assuming that in the future I'll be standing up here requesting permission to pull permits and stuff like that to move those gas and water lines and all that, make it an actual compatible use for what we need.
Okay, and you and I discussed the other day when I dropped by your office that you intended, as part of that internet and so forth, that you planned on putting a monitoring system on the building?
Yes, so one of the requirements to be a testing center is that we have to monitor the testing area. We currently in the flight school have 24/7 video and audio surveillance inside there for very much the same reason. Folks come into our facility and they do practical tests with FAA examiners and with designated pilot examiners. So we don't record the actual sessions that are going on when they're doing that, but we do have kind of an open door policy with folks coming and going, taking keys to the airplanes and stuff like that. So we record the activities in our front room. Once we get a high-speed network connection into the terminal building, we would also extend that camera coverage inside the building as well. And for us, it's partly a liability issue, you know, in case somebody slips and falls, we want to see what happened. And secondarily, we have the largest rental fleet in the area. We've got 6 airplanes with 2 more on the way soon. And one of those cameras is currently facing the ramp so that we can see at night if there's any activity going on the ramp. And we would do that for the terminal building if that was requested. We definitely want to do it on the inside because we have a legal requirement to do so if we do the testing center. But externally, it should be super easy for us to add another camera and point out on the ramp. The cameras that we currently have infrared capability, so once the light level drops below a certain point, they flip to black and white, but they see everything in the dark. So anybody that comes or goes in and out of our facility is recorded 24 hours a day.
Are there any questions, Mr. Vowell? Are there any questions from the public on Mr. Vowell? Oh. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I still haven't heard the recusal statement. Do we still need that?
Yeah, let me just enter it for the record because it's Mr. Vowell's first time through the drill. But what he would ordinarily say is he would acknowledge on this item that he is the owner of the Carson Aviation Ventures, which is the applicant in this case, and therefore has a conflict of interest in acting on it on behalf of the Airport Authority. Thus, he's abstaining and stepping down here to present the item. And if he had just said that before, then we'd be all set. And
yes, what you said again.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Since Mr. Vowell will not return to the dais until this is moved upon, if we have no further comments from the public or comments or discussion from the members, I would entertain a motion on this item.
Yeah, I move that we go forward with this.
Member Torres moves to approve the lease of the West Wing of the terminal building on the terms presented.
On the terms presented.
Do I have
second.
A Member White has seconded the motion. All right. Any further discussion on the motion? None heard. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. None heard. One abstention. Motion passes. Thank you. Okay, moving along to item F4. Now that Member Val has resumed his position at the dais. For possible action regarding the request by Dennis Giangreco to lease parcel 219B of airport land in 3 phases for the construction of hangars for aircraft storage. The lease of property would be for 31,500 square feet as phase 1 and include the right to lease an adjacent similar area within parcel 219B as phase 2 and the final area of parcel 219B as phase 3. determine proposed use, modified lease staging, and proceed with appraisal and recovery of the cost of the appraisal. Mr. Giangreco, could you sign in?
Yes.
State your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Dennis Giangreco.
Madam Chairman, if I could just kind of introduce why it's back on the agenda. You already approved going forward with leasing out this parcel. However, when it was presented to you before, it was presented to you as leasing it as one piece. I subsequently had, and Mr. Giangreco was ready to advance the funds, or maybe he already has, for the appraisal. And that's when he approached me and said, oh, his intention was to do it in basically lease it in three pieces. I told him that we would need to put that back on the agenda because that was not the action that I understood you had taken at the earlier meeting. And I think he wants to make sure that he's on the right track before he pays for an appraisal. And so with that background, Mr. Giangreco can explain to you what he's proposing to do.
That's exactly what I wanted to do, is just go forward, get the first phase done, and just build it straight out in three phases in 3 years or less.
Let me add one thing to that. I explained to Mr. Giangreco, if the idea is to just lease one section and not mention anything about the other two-thirds of the parcel, you know, we could do it on that basis if you chose to do so, but then we would have to go through the whole same process again for each of the others. If it's his intention to lease the first section with the plan on leasing the second and third section, then we would need to get some kind of compensation for the option that we'd be providing him to lease those additional provisions. And that's a number that's hopefully will also fall out of the appraisal, so that when you get to the next stage, after we get the appraisal back and you get to the stage of putting this out for public bid, you have adequate information to determine what those amounts, minimum amounts, would be. And so I think, I don't know what else.
I'm favorable with that. I add a percentage for the other two parcels while I'm building the first. I don't have a problem with that.
And that would be dependent upon the rates that are shown in the appraisal?
Correct.
Okay.
You know, maybe say for to hold the other two phases, let's say, at a 30% or 40% of what the total would be.
Some rate, yeah.
Yeah, what, yeah, we can come up with a rate. That's fine.
He wouldn't pay the entire amount to hold it as an option. You would pay some lower amount for the option
just
portion.
Hold it as a limit, yeah. Yes. I'm okay with it.
Any questions of Mr. Giangreco?
I do.
Member White.
So on the map that you just gave us,
yes,
you have two places that are marked phase one. There's a phase two and a phase three, and then there's a handwritten phase one. Where's your actual phase one? How are you going to proceed?
The right where the handwritten phase one is, that's where the phase one is going to be, 31,000 square feet from right there.
Okay, so that's going to take in the Corsair?
Yeah, I'm going to put it up against the Corsair and go east. It'll be six hangars, 50 feet of the taxi lane hooked up to the Corsair taxi lane, and then 50 feet on the other side of it will be the phase one. That's the 31,000 square feet total.
So you won't be going into this Thunderbolt phase two area at all?
Well, there's nothing there. This is just an old, this is the original drawing that was proposed in 04.
But my question is, you won't be in that Thunderbolt area in phase one?
I will be, yes. It's going to be 180 feet by 175. So I'm going to, from the end of the Corsair, it's going to be 180 feet east.
Okay.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to attach 30 feet of the taxi lane on the Corsair to make that an 80-foot taxi lane, 100 feet of buildings, three hangars on each side, and then another 50 feet of taxi lane for the backside. So that's 31,000 square feet. So it'll be 17,500 of buildings and 14,000 of taxi lane.
So do you have any expectation how long it might take you to get to your other phases?
I built 54,000 square feet in LA and I did it in 8 months. So I'm sure I can do it under a year as long as I can get it through the planning process. I'm up and running and ready to go. So I don't see it taking under a year to get this first phase done.
The first part. Yes. What about the rest?
Well, just as I sell them, I'm just going to just keep building. If these are all pre-sold, I'll just keep moving with it.
Do you have an expectation what your timeline is for that?
I've got three people interested in hangers right now. That's all I've got as far as interest. Okay.
But you're using a three-year window for completion of all three parcels.
Yes.
That's your estimate at this point.
Or soon.
Okay, 3 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for all three.
Okay. So are these parcels broken up?
No.
In a manner that we can lease one section and not the others and put the others on hold? Can we legally, if this 29A is all one parcel, can we just lease off a piece of that and wait for later to do the rest of that same piece?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And ideally, you would break it. You would do new record of survey and break it into three pieces. But if the way it's going to be offered is with options on the other pieces, then that portion could be dealt with at the termination. So if Mr. Giangreco only built out one phase and said, that's as far as I can go, presumably we would use some of the option money we were paid to pay for the record of survey to reestablish the remaining piece.
Why wouldn't Mr. Giangreco do that?
I would do that.
Why would we do that?
Great. Mr. Giangreco will do it.
If I can't build this out and finish this whole project, whatever I haven't leased, I'll get it resurveyed and turn it back over to you guys.
That was the discussion that you had with me when you called me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't have a problem with that.
That would be my understanding was that he would pay for the resurveying and providing the new parcel map for the remainder.
Okay.
Thank you. I don't have any intention of resurveying it.
Well,
unless, you know, the whole world falls apart. But
just so I can kind of throw this back to get what I understand is Mr. Giangreco's asking is he wants some assurance from you that you will make it available on the basis that he's requesting. He's not asking you at this point, and nor can you at this point agree to issue the lease to him or anything else, because the first step is to get the appraisal. His lack of comfortability, as I understand it, is popping the money for the appraisal, not knowing whether this is something that you will offer when you put it out to lease. And when you do put it out to lease, you may want to put it out to lease on the basis that Mr. Giangreco is describing, which is three phases with an immediate lease on the first phase and options on the other two. Or if somebody wants to come in and lease the whole thing, you could still go forward with that. I'm not suggesting that other people are going to be out there leasing. I have no idea. But you wouldn't be restricted against doing that as well.
Member Val.
If this is a parcel 219A, how do we lease 219A, but only part of it without subdividing it at the beginning? When he gets his lease, wouldn't it be for the entire parcel?
Well, it kind of will be for the entire parcel. However, he'll only be paying an option payment for the other two sections. And if he doesn't exercise that option, then at that point we would break off those pieces. I mean, our hope and expectation, and as Mr. Giangreco was explaining to me, is to build out the whole thing. And so if that's really what we expect to have happen, you have to question whether it makes sense to go ahead and break into each piece right now. Now, well, in a perfect world, that if it didn't cost any money, I would say break it into pieces right now, but that all costs money.
Well, what if, just hypothetically, what if something goes south and he doesn't want to give up 219A and he's got the entire right and title to 219A? How do we break it up afterwards? Wouldn't that require a lease modification with his lease?
My understanding is that when you get to the step where you put this out to bid, you will describe those lease terms. And what you will do is say that the bidder may bid on phase one presently with construction to be completed in 12 months and therefore have and pay an option on phase two and three. And if they don't complete the construction or if they decide to terminate it at that point, the successful bidder would have to pay the costs of doing the record of survey and splitting the lot. You know, and I think I would build some flexibility into that, like I said before.
So his lease would describe his phase one as like a certain number of feet of 219A, not the entirety of 219A?
Correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
And I have to say, this is what I understand here. This is what I understood the proposal to be. If you guys have different ideas, this is a great time to discuss them with Mr. Giangreco.
Member Torres.
Mr. Giangreco, in your first phase, it shows 31,500 square feet. And you mentioned how much of this was hangar?
17,500.
17, and how many hangars is
six
that?
Six hangars.
Six hangars. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? Is there any public question, public comments for Mr. Giangreco? Mr. Leish? Please sign in, state your name for the record. And while there are multiple people at the podium, please state your name each time you start to speak.
Eric Leitch. I am delighted to have Mr. Giangreco here and wanting to build some hangars. I'm thrilled with this. I think it's a marvelous step forward for us. Very, very pleased with it. Having been in a few contracts over my career, I'm a little concerned about the particular way this is evolving, and there may be a simpler way to do what it is I think is being attempted. I'm familiar with contract structure, and I'm sure our attorney can improve on what I'm suggesting, in which when you put this out to bid, it can go out to bid for the entire parcel. And I think that's basically what you're saying. But then there could be a clause in there where the successful winner of that bid could elect to give up the remaining fraction for a certain penalty. Effectively gets where you're going, but it doesn't take the option to take the next piece. You take the whole thing, and you have an option to give it up. There may be a way to skin that cat, which is more generally acceptable, more easily understood. So that the whole point is that whoever wins the bid, hopefully Mr. Giangreco, is releasing the entire portion. And the small incremental cost to be paying for phases two and three are minor compared to the entire cost to building out another 20,000 or so square feet of hangars.
Thank you. I think that's basically where we were headed. Any other discussion or questions from the members? Mr. Takis? Any other comments from the public? Thank you very much. There being no further public comment or questions from the authority members, I would entertain a motion.
I move we approve the request to offer parcel 219B in phases and proceed with appraisal on Mr. Giangreco's advance of the cost of the appraisal with the condition that if someone else gets a lease, he'll be reimbursed for the cost of the appraisal.
Sorry. I have discussion on the motion. I have a motion by Mr. Harvey and a second from Mr. Barrett. Do I have discussion on the motion? Member White.
While I do appreciate somebody coming forward and wanting to create some development on our airport, and I have been very outspoken about needing development on our airport, I'm somewhat uncomfortable with the way this is taking place. One, Council doesn't come across as though he's on very firm footing. We've had a contractor in the past that came forward with what was essentially the same basic idea. I want a piece of this piece of property. I think I'm going to build three sets of hangars, but I can only afford one now. And we turned that developer away. I think we need to be consistent in our decisions. And based on that, uncomfortable with council's direction and the need to be consistent, I'm not going to support this item.
Can I just respond to that? That wasn't my recollection of the prior. The prior approach was a guy who wanted to build one or two hangars, period. He had no intention of building out the entire parcel. And that's where I see a problem. Because if you start down the road of one or two hangars apiece, that's a completely different model. And you have the prerogative to make that decision to do it, but in looking at other airports that take that approach, it ends up being an airport with a much larger staff, like the Minden Airport or Stead, places like that. And that was the concern I had there. This I see a little differently, but it doesn't matter how I see it. It matters how you guys see it. But this proposal, as I understand it, is focused on building out the entire project, and that's Mr. Giangreco's, what he says his past history is with building hangars. So that's where I see a distinction there. But, you know, you get to vote, not me. So however you feel about it is the way you feel about it.
And indeed, what I found in the internet regarding Mr. Greco is a pretty successful efforts at building hangars. But we're here in Carson City, and I think we need to be consistent with our decisions.
And in terms of this proposal, I think the option, or whatever you want to call it, takes care of that. We have protection. That's just my view. Whether those two are exactly alike, I think I'll take the council's view, although I'm sure Maurice has studied it and has his view of it, but I'll go along with our attorney.
All right. In that case, any further discussion on the motion before we go to a vote? I have a motion by Member Harvey and a second by Member Barrett to go forward with this as discussed, to offer, to approve the request to offer parcel 219B in phases and proceed with the appraisal upon Mr. Giangreco's advance of the cost of the appraisal and the condition that if someone else gets the lease, he will be reimbursed for the cost of the appraisal. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
Motion carries. Okay, moving on to item F5 for possible action, discussion to consider a hangar monitoring program to ensure compliance with Carson City Municipal Code Title 19 and the FAA hangar use policy. And this, Mr. Rowe, do you have comments on this, please?
Just to get started, at the April 19th meeting of the Airport Authority, the authority approved to adopt a draft hangar use policy submitted by Eric Leitch with the Airport Users Group with the goal of satisfying the FAA hangar use policy. And it was adopted by the authority for further action down the road. Now, last month, Chairman Law and myself, we had a meeting with the city manager and the fire department, city building department, and the tax assessor set in. And the city manager, Nick Morano, expressed a desire to work towards some sort of policy that we could work together on and get ironed out. The brunt of this item here is to move forward with the policy in order to either establish a working group to come up with a policy and work with the city in order to put something together that the authority can get behind, the city can get behind, and that will satisfy Title 19 and the FAA hangar use policy.
Thank you. My input on this item is that I would prefer if we went forward with developing the storage, the aeronautical use policy first and foremost, with what we've gone forward with, and then to add a separate policy with the city to go forward with whatever works for them to do whatever inspections they deem necessary upon report of an infraction of some sort. So that's my feeling. And I'd like to open it up to discussion specifically on the attachment that we had that is the hangar, the storage hangar use policy, to see if there are any other changes or comments to be made on that policy to go forward in time to get it in effect before the FAA deadline. Mr. Takis?
Did you want me to just run through the comments and changes from the last time you guys looked at this? That might be easiest. In the red line version, we've added language that incorporate comments from the chairman, comments that we received from other people, some observations that I had for improvement, and we also incorporated some of the feedback we had gotten from the FAA in the process of the informal complaint that was filed. And so what we first did is if it's vacant, reserved, the hangar is vacant, reserved for aircraft domiciled at another airport, or for anticipated aircraft purchase, that's a legitimate use under the FAA hangar use policy. But we added anticipated aircraft purchase within a reasonable amount of time. Now, that may differ depending on the kind of airplane. If somebody's replacing a Cessna 150, that's going to be a shorter time than if someone's replacing a Citation jet, probably. But what we want to do is make sure we don't have like this kind of loophole in here where someone just says, oh, well, I'm going to buy something, and therefore I can continue using it without any aircraft in it. And so we wanted to close that off. The next one, we had other aeronautical activity. And after talking to Mr. Leitch, I thought this was a pretty good thing to include because it leaves it open in case we have to make a close call on what something is or is not aeronautical activity. The FAA's reaction is, wait, that's our decision to make, not yours. Well, I think it's going to end up being both of our decisions to make. And so I added language saying as long as it doesn't conflict with the FAA policy, because we don't want to adopt something that's in conflict with the FAA. And then you can skip through to the third page, and we picked a time period for the hangar projects to put together the information to provide to us so that we can see they're in compliance. It's really the first step, and it may end up being the last step of a process if we're satisfied with the information that we get. And so we put in 60 days after approval of this policy. My anticipation is once you approve this policy or whatever version you approve, we would take it to the Board of Supervisors so it could be incorporated into Title 19, because that's where it should be. And then once the Board of Supervisors approves it, then the hangar owners would have 60 days to provide us that first download of information, which includes such things as what aircraft are in their hangar, and numbers, owners, lessees, occupants, to the extent it's different than the tenant. And then we added language that they provide it to us for the retention and distribution, not just to the airport manager, but to you guys, because we think it's very important that each of you know what's going on in the airport and with this information, particularly since this issue has been repeatedly brought to our attention by the FAA and others. We added occupant, lessee, or owner of hangars because we don't know who's the person who's the responsible person with an aircraft in it. It might be the lessee under the lease, the person that we, the airport authority, have leased to. It might be somebody they've sublet to or some other occupant of the hangar. And so we want to make sure we capture the necessary information on the aircraft that's in the hangar. And so we've included all three of those saying, okay, whichever one of you is the responsible party needs to provide us with the information. Ultimately, the tenant that we have on our lease has got to collect it all and get it to us because that's who we have the lease arrangement with. And then it used to say if the airport manager disputes a lessee's claim of aeronautical use, the lessee may appeal the dispute to the entire authority. And what we added is if the airport manager or an authority member disputes the use, that way we've got like a check on the fact that if one of the authority members sees something that they think should have not been allowed to use, we've got a mechanism for you to simply say, hey, look, I looked at it, you know, I disagreed with the airport manager on this. And then it comes back in front of you, and as a group, you'll make that decision. And then we've got some clarification language that the airport manager acts at the direction and under the authority of the airport authority. And we put in some language that that you're allowed all enforcement actions, including but not limited to increase in rents or eviction of the subtenant hangar occupant. We have a lease with the hangar owners, and the lease says if you don't comply with the lease, one of the remedies is we can terminate your lease. If it ever came to that, that's a pretty extreme remedy. And so what we're proposing in here is a lesser remedy or a lesser solution, which is alternatively, instead of terminating your entire lease, which could be harmful to all the other people in the hangar association who are dutifully paying their rent and keeping aircraft in there, what we do is we've created a financial disincentive for someone to use it for non-aeronautical purposes or to lie to us, to misrepresent the facts to us. And so what we're doing is we're setting it up as a mechanism that will produce additional revenue to the airport if somebody is using it for non-aeronautical use. And it's not just set just at the rate that mini storages would be other places, which is the minimum amount it could be. Instead, we've somewhat arbitrarily at this point picked the number of $1,000 a month per hangar, because we're not in the business of renting mini storages. Moving it to the rate of mini storages is essentially saying that we're indifferent as to whether it's used as a mini storage or a hangar for aircraft, just pay the right rate. Well, that's not really the philosophy of the airport, and that really isn't the spirit of the FAA's hangar use policy. The hangar use policy and the Airport Authority Act that created the Airport Authority is geared toward operate the airport to be an airport and hangars to store aircraft. And so that's kind of the structure of the kind of enforcement mechanism. In one version, I had called it a penalty, and the FAA didn't like the use of the word penalty because they'd like to think more on an economic basis. And so I took that penalty language out. And but I will be the first to admit to you, I would think that $1,000 a month should be a financial disincentive. Somebody who really doesn't want to have aircraft and store aircraft in their hangar, they want to do something else in their hangar, that should be a good signal to them that maybe you should go do it someplace where that kind of activity is more appropriate, not on the airport. And then we added a provision that if the airport manager or a member of the authority verifies that it's in compliance with the aeronautical use policy, then it's considered in compliance. We need some kind of way of assuring these people once they produce whatever information or allow inspection, however it's going to turn out, that you can give them the assurance that, hey, you're okay. And so that can come either from the airport manager or a member of the authority. And then I dropped off the comments that Mr. Leitch had included in his earlier draft. They were explanatory, and one of them, I think, was misinterpreted by the FAA when they looked at it. There was a provision in there about providing documentation to the authority, and the gentleman from the FAA seemed to think that we were abdicating some responsibility and we should not allow any kind of delegation of providing the information. And that person from the FAA seemed to be hung up on inspections. I can understand it if we're telling somebody else to inspect it, but what we're really doing is saying, look, our lease is with you, association, and so we need you to help us, and we need you to be responsible for showing us that there's compliance. I would think in many cases an inspection of the hangar would give you absolutely no information in terms of compliance. The simple example is we have people at our airport that live here but have a business in Southern California or someplace else. They have hangars in both locations. Their aircraft shares those two hangars. Sometimes it's here and sometimes it's there. That's a legitimate aviation use under the FAA's policy. If you go do an inspection and it turns out the airplane's not there that day, that doesn't give you any meaningful information. What that communicates to you is, oh, this is in violation. You know, at least that would be your first reaction. It would be much more helpful to us to get documentation from the person showing us, hey, I've got these two hangars, the airplane flies back and forth, and that's why if you go out there on a random day, you got a 50-50 chance of seeing an empty hangar versus one with an airplane in it. And I don't think the FAA person had really thought that through, because I think if that had been explained to them, the light would come on and they would say, yeah, that's probably a better way to satisfy that kind of aeronautical use. There's a couple of other things in that were in the FAA's response that I didn't include in here, in part because I'm not really sure where they're coming from. For example, there were these random comments about the airplane needs to be airworthy. Well, are we really going to go out and determine airworthiness of an airplane? I don't think so. Airworthiness of an airplane in first instance is determined by the FAA with an FAA certificate in which you have to carry in your airplane at all time, your airworthiness certificate. And then beyond that, the pilot or owner needs to be responsible for determining the airworthiness. So in the example that was given to me, if my airplane has low air pressure in the tire, I may deem it to be non-airworthy, but that shouldn't have any play on whether I have an active airplane in the hangar. And so the airworthiness thing, I think someone just got a little too excited and started throwing around FAA terms that I don't think are really correctly applicable. I think a concept that they're trying to get across is that the airplanes in it are operational or under construction or under repair, because the FAA has specifically said, if you're building an airplane, that's okay. That's now considered an aeronautical use. And certainly, we all have to repair our airplanes from time to time. That should not be a reason why we get kicked out of our hangar or have to pay a greater rent. And so that's what the policy does. I kind of like it because, of course, I spent a lot of time with it and a lot of time with Mr. Leitch. And so I deserve some credit for something. No, no, he's a very bright guy. And very diligent in this, but that's what the new policy does. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions you have, and I know Mr. Leitch would as well.
Thank you, Mr. Takis. Any questions from the members? Any discussion on Member Val?
The folks that you're talking with at the FAA, are these attorneys, or are they just people that are really trying to influence the policy?
I actually haven't been talking to them. There's a guy named Armstrong who writes letters to us in relation to the complaint that was filed against us. But it's kind of odd because his letters say, but if you have any questions, don't contact me, contact a guy named Tony Garcia. I did email him at one point when he first notified us there was a complaint filed against us, and I sent him an email asking for a copy of the complaint and was told, well, we don't really have a written complaint. We just have somebody who's called a whole lot, and one of the superiors said, look into this, and that's what prompted the first letter. So I haven't had any real communications. I don't think Mr. Armstrong's an attorney, but I don't know. It doesn't appear on his signature block as anything, and I'm guessing that if he was an attorney, he'd probably put Esquire on it.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm just wondering how much weight their opinion carries in terms of how much influence does that organization have on our policy that we're setting?
It's kind of they don't legally and directly they don't, but the important process that we have involves working with the FAA because the FAA gives us the majority of the funding that we get through our FAA AIP grants, and if they come to the conclusion that we're not complying with FAA requirements, they can also say, hey, from now on you don't get any grants. One of the assurances that we get, that we give them each time we sign a grant, is that we will comply with the FAA rules, guidelines, policies, et cetera. I think they're just splitting some hairs. It may be that they're thinking, because early on it sure sounded like they were thinking about a different airport model, an airport model where the airport owns the hangars. And when you read the airport use policy, it's pretty clear a whole bunch of those provisions are written that way, and you have to scratch your head to say, well, how would that even apply to us? And there are other provisions in the airport policy that we can't legally do, which would be for us to manage the rental rates of hangars. I mean, our model is we allow a developer to build an entire development. We allow condo ownership, which is somewhat popular, particularly in the western United States. And then if the owner of the hangar wants to sublease it to somebody else with an airplane, they can do it. We don't have privity of contract with that subleasee such that we could dictate what that rental rate would be. Our belief is that if we have enough hangars out there and we've got a big enough set of people leasing and people renting to them, that you know, the competitive market will take the place. People pay what's an appropriate price for a rental. And I have never heard on our airport of anybody charging an outrageous rent. And candidly, I know a lot of pilots, and I don't think pilots would take very well to paying an outrageous rent. They'd take their airplane to a different airport. So I think it works fairly well for us. It's kind of hard to fit our model into that airport hangar use policy that the FAA adopted in some areas. That's one area. But overall, this policy that's being proposed to you, much of it is copied word for word from the FAA policy because it makes sense. Like each of the aeronautical uses, that was copied directly out of the policy. So I would think that when the FAA looks at this, they're going to say, geez, that looks awfully familiar. They copied it right out of our policy. But these comments that we got in this complaint letter, which are not, they're not in this proceeding and they don't have to do with what we're doing right now, those sometimes are a little bit off, but I suspect it's because the people who are writing those are not as familiar with our hangar arrangement as we are. I think that's what's going on.
So is it a true statement that the FAA grant money has not directly subsidized the building of any of the hangars that we have?
That is absolutely true.
So where do they derive authority to even enforce a policy on us if they didn't pay for any of it?
Yeah, and that's a great argument, and people made that argument when this policy was under consideration. And so when the FAA issued the policy, they addressed that directly, and got it right here. They have a section of on comments in advance, of the policy before they get to – you read the policy itself, it's really like two pages. It's really short. You read all the comments and questions, it's pretty long. But one of them was exactly that. Let me find it really quickly. One of them was more broadly, why don't you just defer to local government and leave all regulation of hangar use to the airport operator? And they essentially said, hey, we're the ones who give out the money so that we can have a uniform system of aviation across the country. There's got to be some give and take here, and we think it makes more sense for us to do it. And they also have some federal law that gives them the basis for doing that. And they also say, however, their final policy was revised in response to those comments. So they're basically saying they moved in that direction, in the direction toward more local control. And they do allow some local control. Okay, I cannot find the question and answer. But that issue was brought up, and what the FAA essentially said is FAA grant process requires everybody to comply with the FAA regulations. They want uniform regulations, so they're going to apply to everyone, even if they are not airport-owned hangars. And that's fine as a general statement, but then when you start drilling down to how do you actually apply this, like how would you dictate minimum or maximum rental rates, okay, well, that kind of breaks down because how do we tell someone who we've leased a hangar, leased bare dirt to, who's put their money in to build the hangar, what amount of money they need to recover their investment on their hangar. That's not even an exercise that I think we're qualified to do. We certainly aren't legally able to do. And so some of these things break down, but I haven't seen anything in any of the communications from the FAA saying, we're going to make you do it anyway. I mean, I think to some extent they're trying to be reasonable. I just mentioned that a couple of their comments, I think they get a little too excited. And
thank you. My comment on this is the document that we have here, this draft policy, integrates what the FAA has said that they want as a basic tenet as far as this policy is concerned. And although it doesn't perhaps encompass everything that's in their policy, it encompasses the things that are most appropriate to our circumstance. That is my feeling about it. It has gone through a number of iterations, and I think that this one is pretty solid. At least it's something that we can have if we adopt it tonight. It is something we can have ready to submit to them and tell them that we are moving forward to comply with their July 1st policy, their policy that will come into effect July 1st. As far as the part of it that has to do with monitoring or inspecting, I think that that can build upon this and be a separate standalone document should we choose to go down that direction in future. Yes, Member Bell.
On the issue of the what you called the financial disincentive, which sounds like a penalty rate, let's say we go down that road and somebody actually gets assessed a penalty rate because they can afford it and they just don't care, the rules don't apply to them. Where does that put us in terms of a legal footing with the FAA? Is the FAA still going to breathe down our throats because we're allowing this activity to continue because we're getting paid for it?
No, actually, the FAA is, well, we would do two things. One is we would notify the FAA that we have a non-aeronautical use and ask them to note that, you know, to approve that use or let us show it on our ALP, our airport layout plan. But their rules say if you allow non-aeronautical use, the rate must be at least the rate that would be charged for that kind of use of property. So by us putting it at that number, which I think is comfortably above, you know, I don't think anybody could come back and argue, oh, that's still below the rate that somebody would charge for mini storage. I think that we're safe there. So it's a one-way thing, I think.
So does that mean that we're okay to continue with that non-aeronautical use if we notify them and we charge that rate?
I believe so. That's how I understand the policy works. You know, the way they described it, they were thinking more along the lines of an airport has a section of the airport that they've decided, look, we can't use that for aeronautical use. Either there aren't enough people out there who want to use it, or there's something about it. Designate that area on your airport for non-aeronautical use, and then we will look at that and approve that. And they've done that for some airports, including one airport in Nevada. And Mike Williams, the director of the airports district office in Phoenix, which is the office that we work through, told me which airport it is, and for the life of me, I can't remember. He told me at the Nevada Airports Association. But that does happen. I think it's somewhat unlikely, though, that someone's going to want to pay an extra $1,000. But, I mean, we'll have to look at that and see. I mean, if we thought that $1,000 wasn't enough in terms of charging for a comparable use outside the airport for non-aeronautical use, then we'd have to adjust that. And by the way, as long as I got the mic here, I don't know why. Of course, when I stopped talking before, I immediately saw the question that you had asked. It was comment number two. Commenters, including AOPA, stated that the FAA lacks authority to regulate the use of privately owned hangars, which was essentially the point that you were asking. They responded to talk about the National Aviation Network and how things need to be uniform, but the last sentence is, an airport sponsor may choose to apply different rules to hangars owned by the sponsor than it does to privately constructed hangars, but the obligations of the sponsor grant assurances and therefore the basic policies on aeronautical use stated in this notice will apply to both. And so they are giving us some flexibility, or they're acknowledging there should be some flexibility for privately owned hangars, but the bottom line is, what is the use of the hangar? And their major thrust of this policy is it needs to be aeronautical, and they define what that is. And for most of us, that means there's an active airplane in the hangar, which is also what Title 19 requires, which is that all hangars have active airplanes in them. Now, we know there's going to be hangars that don't have any. If there's a hangar out there that's out for rent and it doesn't have a tenant, it's going to be empty. It's not going to have anything in it. And the FAA understands that. But what they're trying to avoid are situations where people are using hangars for non-aeronautical purposes, which are preventing people who have airplanes who need a hangar to put their airplane in. And that's really the thrust. Sorry, I talked too much.
Mr. Leish, do you have a comment or question? Please identify
Eric
yourself.
Leish. This has been a moving target, so it's very possible that I've missed a step. But it seems to me that in regard to your question about what happens if somebody simply wants to go ahead and pay the elevated rate of $1,000, I believe, unless it's changed, that the authority still retains the option to terminate the lease. I mean,
That's correct. I mean, you know, the leases say they're for aeronautical use. So you could still say, hey, wait a second, that's not going to be okay. And so our option is we're going to give you notice that we're going to terminate. And all of our leases have a provision saying if we give you a notice to terminate, you have a certain period of time to cure that. And that would give the association time to work with the recalcitrant hangar owner to figure out what they're going to do.
So then, again, what I'm trying to clarify is that what I believe was the intent here is that all of the rights that the authority has always had are in this policy. What's been added is an additional tool that the authority has the option of doing something less than evicting. They have the option of the raise the rent, but they haven't given up any other rights that they would have as a landlord.
That's the way I understand it as well.
One more question. Do we have a list or any complaints from folks in the past that have said that they couldn't get a hangar because so many of our hangars have this problem? Is this a solution to a problem that we actually have or we don't?
The only complaints I've had are verbal complaints and nothing substantiated.
But was it ever in the context of, I have an airplane and I don't have anywhere to put it because all these other hangars are full?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got a waiting list personally in the office of four people who are looking for hangar space.
Okay, let me be clear on that, though. I'm not aware of any of those people. They say, hey, I've got an airplane, I need hangar space. I haven't heard any of those people say, and I can't get it because you're allowing a non-aeronautical use. That part of it I have not heard before. We have had one person who keeps complaining that we're allowing non-aeronautical use, but every time he identifies hangars or other stuff, we find that it's simply not true.
Okay, that was my specific question, because I'm wondering if this whole policy is a solution to a problem that we don't have. I mean, I get that the FAA has the entire country to deal with, and I know there are places like St. Carlos and Van Nuys and all that where it's like 3 and 4 years long to get a hangar because they just don't have enough, but is that actually the problem that we have here, and are we really just like kind of beating a dead horse on a problem that we don't have?
It may be the latter. It may be that we're beating a dead horse. But when the FAA land use auditor, Mr. Robert Wiley, came out and did his inspection, one of the things he heard from is he heard from our person who was complaining. And I think his thinking is the best way to deal with a complaint, even an elusive one where it throws hangar numbers out there and other stuff, then we go check it out and it's not true. The easiest way to deal with that is to have a policy in place so you know what's not going on.
Member White.
So, Steve, I'm looking at your council's brief rather than the clean version. And on paragraph 2G, where you're talking about it, it's an approved or an acceptable use if you're anticipating the purchase of a airplane within a reasonable amount of time. Do you have a sense what is a reasonable amount of time?
I think it's going to depend on the circumstances of the aircraft. So, for example, if you had somebody who collected a particular kind of airplane and had a history of owning that kind of airplane, if it's an airplane that's not very easily found, example might be one of the Grumman models, you know, Grumman Widgeon. You know, there's people who love that airplane. You know, Jimmy Buffett is one of them. He's kind of made him famous. And if that's what you're replacing your widgeon with, another widgeon, it's probably going to take you longer to find that because there's such a small supply than if you're replacing it with a Cessna 150, which are, you know, every airport that I've ever been to has had bunches of Cessna 150s on hand. So it's going to depend, I think.
So, yeah, I kind of had that in mind. It's going to depend on the person. It's going to depend on the target. So is there a way to put some language in there that suggests you must be able to show you're making progress on a search for a plane, you have a plane in escrow, you are actually looking for a plane instead of just saying you are?
Yeah, I would love it if we could come up with some language to do that. I tried, but I couldn't. I couldn't come up with it. And so what I kind of deferred to is I thought, okay, this is going to be kind of a fact-by-fact situation. They're going to make their pitch to you. And if it's convincing to you, great. You'll say, oh, it's okay. If it's not convincing to you, you'll say, not buying that.
Okay.
That's not a reasonable period of time to me, and end of discussion.
Okay. So then down at 5E, and I apologize,
I missed this on my checklist, so I haven't reviewed Article 19. But does not Article 19 say that each hangar must have an airplane registered in Carson City?
Yeah.
And if it does, then how do we do this when this airplane that is hangared in two locations is actually registered in the remote location from Carson City? How do we handle that?
Yeah, okay, because Title 19 doesn't exactly say that.
Okay.
So here's what Title 19 says. The premises are to be used and occupied primarily for aircraft storage, and at least one aircraft will be housed in each occupied hangar. Aircraft housed in a hangar will be listed as personal property with the Carson City Assessor's Office, or if domiciled at another location, documentation provided to support such classification. Because we can't make somebody register their plane here.
Right.
But we do try and capture all the airplanes here because we'd like the personal property tax to be here in Carson City as opposed to Van Nuys, California, or someplace else.
So I think just for the people that are going to be involved, as you went through this policy, creating this policy, you said you had some of the city personnel involved. I assume involved the assessor, Dave Dolly. Do you have any idea how he's going to determine what airplanes are registered here and what isn't? Because I know we have a list. Linda and I have come up with a list. What was there, 900-something planes registered in Carson City?
I, referring to the list, and I don't want to get too far off topic here, but I have printed out the most current one, and I've met with Dave Dolly, and I'm in the process of starting a spreadsheet that I can put those together. But
so we're going to get to that part.
We will get to that part eventually.
And so I know a lot of people have been involved putting this together. Do we have a sense that I would hope all, but at least the majority of the tenants on the airport are aware that this is happening and that they feel like they've had an opportunity to contribute? Because I only see, you know, what do we have, five people here. I mean, we have more board members than we have audience. I would think something like this being created new would create a firestorm. I mean, other things way more minor than this have filled this room. So has everybody had a chance to chime in on this?
Okay, there has been a good deal of communication. I can tell you that firsthand. It's been on the agenda several times. We published the agenda. We put it out. These meetings are televised. I think we've done the right thing in terms of getting the word out. And I hate to speak to the ratings of this program, but this tonight is a pretty good audience for this program. But there may be a lot of people that watch us every month on the TV too. I think the word has gotten out. I've certainly heard a lot of reaction each time it's on the agenda. Okay. And so people who seem to be interested are making their voices known.
Okay.
And then you mentioned working with the city departments. I just tell you personally, I was not at the meeting that Mr. Rowe referred to about talking to the city departments. I have not talked to Dave Dolly about that issue or to Nick Morano, the city manager, about doing some kind of cooperative inspections. But I truly believe that the chairman has said it right, which is we need to develop policy before anybody sits down and talks about bringing in city resources to do things that they probably have other things to do as well. And they probably don't want to do this, yeah.
I can say that at that meeting there was interest in doing some of that sort of thing. But I think that this policy is going to be the hanger upon which other things are placed.
Right.
And not that it's going to get, you know, snowball into something that is huge and unwieldy, but I think that this is a beginning for us to show the FAA that we are trying to comply with what they want us to do and give us a place to start with some other items as well. Any other comments from members? Member
yes.
Barrett.
Thank you. I seem to recall at the beginning of this telling some people that my attitude was and still is that because the federal government gives us 95% and assigns the FAA on our grants, and that's what that concrete out there represents, and that the FAA is the watchdog, for lack of a better term, that we have to do pretty much what the FAA wants us to do. At the same time, I said if they want inspections, they ought to come down here and inspect it themselves. But, of course, that probably isn't going to fly, no pun intended. The truth of the matter is, though, that as the representative of the city on this board and a liaison, I guess I'd say, that the city does own the land underneath, and so we have an interest in making sure that that 95% keeps coming. So I would say that in the future, if there's not adequate monitoring or inspection language in here, that perhaps there would be an overlaid effort. I haven't talked to the city manager or the other people you mentioned, but it seems to me we have to do that. I understand that most of the people who are watching out there and probably on television don't particularly want that to happen in any regressive fashion, but nevertheless, we're going to protect that money that comes for the concrete. And that's all I have to say on it. I'm perfectly willing to pass this and go on working towards satisfying the FAA, although I don't much care for the fact that that we had a civil war and a couple of other things like an income tax that says those guys are the big guys and we're the small guys. It doesn't really impress me much.
Any other comments?
Member Torres. Member White mentioned how does the assessor know who has an airplane in the hangar? They send out annual letters to hangar owners asking what's in the hangar.
Any further public comment before we move on this? Dr. Graber.
Hi, Brad Graber again. And specifically in answer to Mr. White's question, the reason there are so few people here is that the vast majority of the hangars are in total compliance. That's why, you know, you don't see that. We don't have a big problem at this airport. Mr. Takis correctly says that the FAA did not speak to our model. Please remember that our airport is gifted land from John D. Winter's estate. Please remember that every single hangar has been built by entrepreneurs. Please know that those hangars on our airport represent somewhere in the neighborhood around $30 million. Please know that that $30 million results in a tax base that goes about 48% to the airport. I think the number is close, 52% to the schools. Please know that the FAA is really concerned that an airport does not keep people waiting for hangars. And so the model that we have had and continue to have is that when an entrepreneur wants to build some more hangars, it's good for everybody. That would be, sorry to be so flippant, that would be good for the kids. All right? So know that also that in their policy to go into effect on July 1, all right, they're really concerned we store airplanes. But number one, general, says, and by ensuring that airport sponsors receive fair market value for use of airport property for non-aeronautical purposes. I suggest to you that $1,000 is not the fair market value, and I would offer for you to give consideration to that based on the fact, Mr. White, that we have so few hangars there. And in fact, Mr. Leitch's first suggested hangar use policy included some very reasonable suggestions and policies for the use of these very few hangars that are there to be charged a fair market value. Please know that the last line of the policy to go into effect is, quote, the FAA may disapprove an AIP grant for hangar construction if there are existing hangars at the airport being used for non-aeronautical purposes. That's right in line with what they want. They want hangars here for airplanes, and they don't want a list, and we are really pretty much in compliance. Pretty much in compliance. They're not going to stop sending us 96 cents on our dollar for our runway repair and maintenance for a few hangars that we have charged something less than $1,000 a month. They're not going to do that. They need this airport right here. We're one of the very few and closest airports to Reno. One of the reasons that they've spent money here is because we are that close to Reno. One of the reasons that they let us extend our airport is because if there's some kind of terrible situation that occurs, this airport can handle the action. So I think it's foolhardy to suggest that because we have a hangar policy that best suits our conditions here, that language is in here someplace, that local conditions may dictate, they are simply not going to stop paying us money when we need to have it. So I would offer for your review the original Eric Leitch document so that you could see another way to approach those very few hangars that don't have an airplane in it. Very few. Otherwise, you'd see a whole bunch of folks here. I really appreciate you listening. You have the chance to change this airport forever. And it's going to be something that some folks can live with and some folks can't, depending upon what you decide. So what we don't want to do is we don't want to short ourselves in this city by not increasing on that $30 million investment. We want to encourage folks to get here and build hangars. Appreciate you listening. Questions of me?
Any questions of Dr. Graber? Thank you. Any further public comment on this item? Any further discussion of the members? At this point, I would entertain a motion to approve the hangar use policy and direct staff to proceed with changes to Title 19 with the Board of Supervisors.
I would move for that.
Member Torres has moved for adoption. Do I have a second? Member Harvey has seconded. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion passes. Thank you. Moving on to item number F6. For possible action to approve engagement of William Kimmel, MAI appraiser, to update the aircraft storage appraisal dated July 2016 per the request of George Byard for a lease extension of an aircraft storage only lease. Mr. Takis.
Yes, this item follows on the other lease extensions that we did. We voted on here at the Airport Authority in December, this past December, and the Board of Supervisors approved it in early January. The process involves aircraft storage only hangars. It does not apply to full service FBOs under the statute, but it allows the Airport Authority to extend leases based on a current appraisal. At the time, we had a current appraisal from Mr. Kimmel. I can't remember what it cost. It cost like $4,000, $4,500, something like that, dollars. In talking to Mr. Kimmel, when I was afraid that we wouldn't have time to act before the appraisal was 6 months old and therefore not considered current under the statute, he indicated that he could do an update to the appraisal for a very reduced fee, and I think he said $1,000, but it might be slightly more than that, but considerably less than the cost of an appraisal. When he did the first appraisal, we had him include most of the storage-only hangars on the airport, everyone who had indicated an interest in extending theirs. Mr. Byard's lease was included in that group. Mr. Byard had a bunch of family issues going on, and for him to be involved in that first bunch would have been unreasonable based on what he's told me. And as a result, he's now wanting to go forward. I told him, well, we got to have a current appraisal. He's agreed to advance the funds to update the appraisal. Whatever the appraisal comes in, that would be the new rate. Plus, if you recall, we didn't just move it to the appraised rate. We also charged an opportunity cost, a flat fee up front to be able to do it, because I think that's a reasonable thing for the airport to receive. And so he would also be subject to that. He would also be subject to the additional lease extension requirements that the Board of Supervisors asked us to put in, which involve a 10-year check on the fair market value, because we have a CPI index, but it may not match up to what really happens with property, change in property values. And then it also has a provision saying that he has to make an ongoing investment in the hangars, and we average that over a 10-year period, and that was, I want to say, like 4 cents a square foot, averaged over 10 years. And then also there's a provision that needs to be added that says if the use of the hangar is ever changed by this authority to allow more than aircraft storage only, then the rent jumps to the full FBO appraised rate. And the last time we did that, I think the rate was like 36 cents. It's much considerably higher than aircraft storage only. And so what he's asking for is approval to proceed with the appraisal. He's going to advance the funds. I don't see any downside to this to the airport authority. You'll decide later whether you're going to actually grant the extension.
Any questions of Mr. Tagus? Any public comment or public questions on this item? There being none, I would entertain a motion to approve the request and authorize the appraisal update upon Mr. Baird advancing the appraisal fee to the airport authority. Member White has moved.
Second. I move to approve item F6 as presented.
We have a second from Mr. Bell, from Member Bell. Any discussion on the motion? Any public comment on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. None heard, motion carries. Moving forward, we turn to the informational items on the agenda. We will begin with the airport engineer's report.
Brian Fitzgerald, airport engineer with Atkins. To fear of repeating myself, the north apron lights are not complete yet. As stated, Par Electric has done all their work and put the new pedestal in. NV Energy has been notified after the city signed off on the pedestal, and has not been constructed as of today. So we're waiting basically to connect the wires at this point and be able to move forward on that. Once all that's done, we'll probably have about a month and a half of closeout documents, and then the project could be completely closed out probably within 2 months of, say, today. So with that, the project has actually been under budget. Unfortunately, it has extended the time because of our change orders that we had with the ceiling on the north apron there. But otherwise, I've heard lots of good comments about it, so I think we're moving forward with finally getting that project closed out. Also, the airport master plan, at the time of my writing on my memo, I had no new news. However, I have spoken with the FAA, and they are currently working on that grant. Believe it's going to be moving forward and being delivered to the airport within 2 weeks. So once that is been received and signed off, then we'll be able to move forward and start on the airport master plan. If I hear of anything different, I will alert the authority on that, but I do expect to see it sometime beginning of July. Any questions on that?
I do have one question. When was the ceiling actually completed?
When was it? It was performed on the 24th and 25th for the ceiling, and on the 26th there was striping of May.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions of Mr. Fitzgerald? All right, we'll move to the airport manager's report. Tim?
There's no new news since my briefing was published and entered into the record. If there's any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer.
Member White?
Yeah, Tim, last month we heard some concerns about mosquitoes and bugs in ponding between the taxiways. Have you been able to address that?
There's nothing to address the taxiways. The water's leached into the ground. We have no problem with bugs.
Any other questions of Mr. Rowe? We will move on.
Chairman, I'd like to add.
Brian.
His first item was the aircraft incident that occurred last month. I just want to add that I looked at the damage to the runway itself, and there was no significant damage. It's mostly visual. So I don't believe there's going to be any problems in the near future or even long term for the runway.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Member Vowell.
In regards to that incident, it brought up a question that I had. Do we have a media access policy or something like that in regards to when those types of events occur? I know that there were a bunch of media people that were trying to gain access to the airport, and they didn't really have anybody to talk to or anything like that. Do we have something in writing that's in terms of are they guaranteed access when something like that happens?
No, they're not guaranteed access to the airport.
They're not.
There have been times in the past of an incident where they've caught me at the terminal, and as usual, I can't give any information because of the nature. The FAA has control of the accident or incident. I don't divulge who the pilot is or extent of any injuries or damage, that sort of thing. I just have to be very vague with them.
Any other questions? We'll proceed to the legal counsel's report.
Just real quickly, as Brian indicated, the FAA grant should be on its way soon. We got a call from Senator Cortez Masto's office telling us that. They always tell our U.S. Senate contingency before they tell anybody else, and so they're usually the first ones to call. The other thing to report is the Board of Supervisors has approved the changes to Title 19 for the updated through-the-fence fees, and so that's in place now. So whenever the next cycle comes up for charging those fees, the airport manager will utilize the new fees. The other news, Chairman Law, I'm sure you're familiar with both of these bills. SB 528 put in $100,000 per year into the governor's budget, into the final approved budget, that goes to the Aviation Trust Fund. That's the fund that sits at NDOT and gets distributed to rural airports to be used as matching grants. We've gotten money out of that before. We're considered one of the rural airports, and so that's a good thing. The other bill that was approved was Senate Bill 64. The avgas tax the jet fuel tax came back to the airport where it was charged, but the avgas tax was going to fund the Civil Air Patrol. The FAA launched last year an effort across the country to say, hey, wait a second, guys, all aviation fuel tax has to come back to the airport where the fuel was sold. No ifs, ands, or buts. And when they looked at ours, they pointed out to us, hey, you got to fix that. We told them, hey, we got to fix the statute. This isn't something that the Airport Authority can just do. And Kurt Haukuhl from the Nevada Department of Transportation's Aviation Group pursued this legislation, which fixed it. So now sales tax on avgas will come back to the airport. It's not a big number. It's a really small number. But more importantly, we're now in compliance with the federal law, which is very important to the FAA. That's all I have to report.
Thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Takis? We'll move on to our treasurer's report. Mr. Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the reports you have, and I noticed nothing unusual, but I do want to put something in the record that Mr. Takis had sent me copies to the chair and Tim, but that we do have rent from Shade Tree will jump to $2,500 a month beginning September 1st, 17. This is due to an extension we did back in 14, but it wasn't effective until August 20th. So that wasn't in our budget, you know, we hadn't anticipated. I spoke with Beth Cohn, and it's not like a huge number, but it's a number we'll probably look at augmentation during the mid-year. So we already got the budget approved. We don't want to mess with that with the state. But to know that that's a little bit through there. The Board of Supervisors also approved the increase in the through-the-fence fees. Affects two users, two companies this year, but they're pretty small impacts. But all those little small impacts add up, so it's nice to those little pieces. So just an FYI that will augment the budget as we look down further in the year.
Question.
Member White.
I have a couple of questions. Tim, on the profit and loss budget versus actual, that would be page 8 of the attachment that you sent out. On the second page of that profit and loss budget versus actual, line 6306 for waste management, that shows that we've spent 1,080.9% of the budget. And then again, if you go down to line 6313, insurance, that shows that we have spent 1,359.9% of the budget.
The budget numbers are wrong.
You know, Tim, I do have that a question on that, in that if you look at what I see presented, it actually, the dates aren't right. They say May 31st to July 1st, 16. They don't appear to be the right amounts for this time of year. So I got to say, I have a question on that particular report.
Obviously, I made a mistake with the dates. Should have been from July 1st to May 31st.
So once again, we have a financial report that we can't rely on.
Okay.
The other one I'll just mention, Tim, is on the other report, profit loss year-to-date comparison. It's you're comparing the same year. We don't have the previous year to compare with, so I'm not sure what occurred there.
Again, I will be careful next year or next time.
So if you'd please review those. Let's look at last year's and resend these out. I'd appreciate it.
I will.
Any further questions on that item? All right. Are there any reports from the authority members?
I just want to say right now to everyone, I apologize for my cell phone ringing. I don't usually leave it on during meetings, but I've been trying to connect with my daughter who lives far away. And so I told her I'd call her back, but I didn't want to turn it off this time because we've been working on this for 3 days. Thank you.
Anything further from members? Anything more from any of our staff? Any further public comment? There being none, we are adjourned. Anybody have agenda items for the next meeting? Sorry. If they do, please report them to Tim and we'll get them on the agenda or give them to Steve or I and we'll take care of that. We are now adjourned.